Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
And welcome back to Overnight America. Here we are past midnight. This is what we do. 12:06 in St. Louis, Missouri. And yeah, I can't believe Brad just did the Bob Costas story. I didn't know he was going to be covering that in the local news. So Bob Costas, unplugged. That's the headline from ESPN. It reads, from NBC and broadcast icon to dropped from the Super Bowl. And they have a really good story online on Outside the Lines on ESPN.com. And I want to read a couple of parts from you, but they posted just a little sample video of him. I don't exactly know what they're trying to do, if they're trying to paint a certain picture of him in this way, if they're trying to make him look like he, you know, is a martyr for a bigger type of idea, which is, you know, trying to stand up to the NFL. And I don't know if they're trying to make this as a, you know, subplot to how the NFL operates to, you know, we already see what's going on with its own lawsuits and the Kaepernick thing. So I was wondering if there was some sort of alternative meaning to putting the story out there to show it's not just, you know, a Kaepernick deal. It's anyone that stands up against the NFL. I don't know. I thought they were trying to draw some parallels. It's what the ESPNs of the world, when they try to politicize this sort of thing. Obviously, Bob Costas has a lot of great will here in St. Louis and KMOX Radio. I'd love to talk to Bob Costas about this, too. But basically, the moral of this story is he wanted to be able to sleep at night. And he wasn't going to hold back his commentary because it meant pleasing the NFL lords. And that's kind of what happened. And it's a tough situation because the company he was working for, NBC, and this is what's laid out in Outside the Lines, you know, they got these billion-dollar contracts and a lot of money could be lost. So it's about pleasing your client. And if your client's the NFL and you depend on the NFL and your network depends on the NFL, what's more important, you know, $5 billion deal with the NFL or one broadcaster whose agreement's probably going to be ending here anyway. So they made their decision. Bob Costas unplugged. Here's what ESPN posted. Take a listen to this.
It's possible to say football is an exciting sport, but there are these undeniable problems.
The issue that is most substantial, the existential issue, is the nature of football itself.
And so it was that 1 year ago, just weeks before he was to host his seventh and final Super Bowl, Bob Costas was removed from the telecast. It all began to fall apart on November 7th, 2017, at a symposium in Maryland.
The reality is that this game destroys people's brains.
Costas's comments went viral, and NBC, whose current contract with the NFL is worth roughly $9 billion, quickly distanced itself from its star. Bob's opinions are his own, and they do not represent those of the NBC Sports Group.
So I guess that NBC is not sure whether there's a connection between football and brain trauma. And I imagine the next press release is, it's still open to question whether or not the earth is round or flat. Okay, I'm good.
Oh, Bob. All right, so with 28 Emmys and 8 National Sportscaster of the Year awards, Costas has become the most respected broadcaster of his generation. They call him the Walter Cronkite of sports. Costas believed it was important to have viewers confront football's existential crisis and consider their own moral dilemma as fans complicit to the sport's carnage. They mention a couple other things in this article. In the end, Costas wished he had never spoken to Outside the Lines about any of it. I guess maybe it's not just that he was comfortable outside of sports. It's that he had melded a near photographic memory with his genuine interest and passion of pop culture, politics, and history. So many different people told me about his memory when it comes to politics and history. It's unbelievable. I forgot who I was talking to here in the building about his memory when it comes to history. But, you know, Bob Costas, when he came to work here at KMOX, was very young. And sometimes you'd have these veteran newscasters that would challenge him. You know, what does this kid know? And he would come out and be able to spout not only statistics, but, you know, historical dates and key figures and names and politicians better than the newscasters could. I mean, he was just that good. I don't know how it can stick in your mind like that. I'm terrible with names. I don't know how a sportscaster could just absorb and just know of all these things. Normally, you find someone that knows a little bit about a lot of things, or a lot of things about a little bit of things. Like, you know, what's the phrase? Yeah, so you know a little bit about a lot of things, or you know an awful lot about one thing. Sportscasters know an awful lot about one thing. It's normally sports, right? They eat, breathe, live, everything sports. Bob Costas knows everything about everything. It's insane. And the article pointed out a few things and said, let's see, Costas told Outside the Lines that his credibility and frankly that of the network relied on his willingness to address hard topics. So during his commentaries you'd hear on Sunday Night Football, you'd normally get a couple of minutes. They would address a couple of things. A lot of times it was just, you know, here's what's going on in football. Here's, you know, a little piece about Lambeau Field. But sometimes it'd be things more serious, and then it would give him an opportunity to do a commentary on things like concussions. He mentioned, too, that he's been talking about this for years. It was just until recently that something changed.
You had a viral moment this week.
This is him on ESPN.
Sensing a brewing conflict with NBC, Costas says he went on CNN to try to tamp things down.
I've been saying these things for the better part of a decade, and often on NBC. I stand by anything I say publicly. But it used to
soon after, Costas says he was contacted by NBC executive producer Sam Flood and told he was being removed from the Super Bowl.
I think the words were, you've crossed the line. And my thought was, what line have I crossed?
Costas says he also spoke with NBC sports chairman Mark Lazarus.
And I remember reminding them of things going back to the 90s, of what I had done, what credibility I would have to comment about these things. And their reaction to that was, you're right, you're right. But this puts us in a position that's untenable for us. So you can't do the Super Bowl.
I have to watch this. Outside the Lines said the NFL took in more than $7 billion from its television partners this season. At ESPN, the network is in the middle of a contract that pays the NFL $1.9 billion per year to air the Monday Night Football. Costas said, look, the NFL isn't just the most important sports property. It's the single most important property in all of American television, and it isn't even close. So because of the stakes, the NFL has an enormous influence over the networks portray the sport. Says Costas, the networks, all of them, dance to the NFL's tune. It's just kind of the way it goes. Everyone walks on eggshells around the NFL. It's like that with any other big client, right? If you are in an industry and you got a big client and you say things to upset the big client, you're probably going to get in hot water. Now, it's not fair by any means. You know, is the business fair? No, business is not fair. It's just not fair. It's just what happens, you know? It's the way it goes. I guess he could start his own sports network if he wanted to. That seems to be the cool thing to do. Or he can come back here to KMOX if he wants to do some fun broadcasting. You know, he's loyal. He says here he felt loyal to NBC to come back to them and do some broadcasting with them. Come back to KMOX. We'd love to have you, Bob Costas. At least, how about you come back and do one show with me and see how it feels? Let's see. He says, I remember the reaction almost verbatim. This is a very well-written piece. Won't change a comma. We can't air it. Costas asked why about his essay he had about concussions. He says, we're in negotiations with the NFL. And he knew that his days were numbered at that point if his commentaries were getting turned down because they were choosing the contracts over him, so he figured that out. He recalled the phrase, it's a six-hour, day-long celebration of football, and you're not the right person to celebrate football, Costas says, to which my response was not, oh, please, please change your mind. My response was, yeah, I guess you're right. He insists that rather than being upset or feeling punished, he felt relieved. which I guess it would be. When you're at that level, you're at that high, what else you got to prove? I mean, you got nothing else to prove. You've done how many other Super Bowls in the past? All of these games, you're recognized as one of the greatest sports broadcasters of all time. Yeah, you got nothing else to prove. You know, you're able to walk away from that and still feel fine. If that would happen to anyone else, if that would have been someone going into their first one, devastating, life-altering. But for Bob, he knows what he's doing. You know, you want to hear some rare Bob Costas? I accidentally found some Bob Costas in the KMOX archives, and I'm going to play that for you next. It was in a really weird spot. Some of you may remember this back in 1990 when KMOX did a live hookup with Japan. I'll explain next on Overnight America KMOX. Welcome back to Overnight America. And I don't know a lot about this hookup. I only know very little about it. But this is a really cool thing I found in the KMOX archives. I'm looking forward to sharing with you. So back in September of 1990, it was a Tuesday night, September 4th, 1990, KMOX experimented with a live broadcast to Japan. And it was really cool. I think they were simulcasting with a Japanese broadcast crew, and they were asking each other questions. So you had our guys asking them questions, being translated, same thing they're asking us, being translated back. And I was listening to this, and I was just, it was fun to listen to the questions because they did some open lines. It happened at midnight here in St. Louis, midnight. So it would have been this hour. But on a Tuesday, September 4th, 1990, and this is long after Bob Costas, of course, left the radio station. He was doing his own thing. He was already well-respected as a sportscaster in his own right, still was able to accomplish a lot. But for whatever reason, he was in the studio that Tuesday night at midnight. Like, what is Bob Costas doing at KMOX that late? I don't get it. On a Tuesday night. And I know that this broadcast to Japan, I think, was one of the first times that ever happened. They asked him all kinds of different questions. There was people calling in asking about what they think about American products. There was people calling in asking them about, you know, culture, food, pets. But I wanted to play this last part where Bob Costas comes in. This is at the very end of the broadcast, and this is about 9 minutes long. But this is how they wrapped up the broadcast to Japan, one of the very first this has ever happened in broadcast history.
This is a comment from Kent.
Hey, Bob.
Well, from Kent?
Well, we are, since we're a very close friend, oh, you're kind enough to invite us to St. Louis, aren't you?
All right, that's fine. Kent, I'll tell you what. We ski in Utah. I'll meet you there and bring you from there to St. Louis. How's that?
Bob, it's a deal.
They can stay at my house.
There you are. You can, you can stay at Mary's house.
It's not that important to invite Kent to St. Louis. Well, the state of you can go to the state of Utah in the morning, and in the afternoon, we can go to St. Louis and spend 3 days there. How about that deal?
Well, this is Bob Hardy talking, by the way.
Utah and eat potatoes right over there, because we potatoes here in Japan, too.
No.
That's so we would like to visit good bars in St. Louis. To listen to good music.
Okay, we can arrange all of that. We'll all stay at Mary's house. How's that? Mary, you just invited us
sure,
all.
Sure, sure. I would like them to have a homestay opportunity in the United States.
Well, that's a good idea. I definitely would like to see Mary as well as Janet. And after seeing them, I would like to look at American people. And I'm sure that I like American women.
Now, wait, who is saying all this?
Well, Mr. Bando.
Oh, Mr. Bando. Uh-huh.
Well, at my house, my daughter spent 2 years in the United States, in Washington and Seattle. And so did my wife. My wife and daughter can speak English. But I usually speak English with only English words, strike, foul ball, or hit, or baseball-related words. That's the only English I know. Since I was a baseball player, so I was very familiar with these English baseball terms. But I can communicate with you heart to heart. Can I?
All right, I'll tell you what. You may communicate with us heart to heart, but one of our favorite young broadcasters has just strolled into the studio, and I probably, I would assume you probably recognize the name of Bob Costas. Robert, good to have you with us.
Bob, good to see you. I don't know if I would be recognized in Japan or not, although increasingly,
broadcasts of American sporting events are carried on satellite around the world. I've been in Europe several times this summer, and American baseball games, football games were carried in Berlin and in London, and I know that baseball is tremendously popular in Japan, so
it's
possible.
Can you hear me there in St. Louis?
Yes.
Bob, I think you're in the middle of a program over there, and I'm breaking in. If you can hear my voice over there, we've lost our break. We've lost our connection with you.
Okay.
We can't hear St. Louis KMOX at all here in Osaka. We think that you can still hear us. If that's the case, you're now hearing my voice. And we're trying to get back so that we can hear you over there so that we can communicate. But what we're doing right now is sitting here talking and hoping that you're hearing us.
All right, we hear you very, very well. And we just introduced...
Maybe we ordinary citizens of Japan can communicate American people more effectively than prime ministers or ministers. So this kind of person-to-person exchange is very important between Japan and the United States. Oftentimes, when people represent the countries, they are worried about their responsibility. Therefore, they can't speak so candidly. But on our part, general public in Japan, we can speak more freely. When the issue comes up like the system of emperor in Japan, well, I feel very awkward speaking about that issue. If I dare to speak about that issue, I feel somewhat like I'm playing a role of a prime minister of Japan, where I can feel that sense very effectively. Being in the Japanese TV program, I often receive questions like, well, what is the situation in the United States, Kent? That makes me feel very awkward. Well, today, through this program, I think many people felt that they wanted to speak more openly to the United States. Suppose half of the all Japanese children visit the United States and half of the U.S. children come to Japan and both of them stay for 10 years in respective countries, then we can lessen the problem and frictions between Japan and the United States.
Our teenagers would drive you nuts.
We now have you back here.
All right.
We now can hear you, Bob.
Okay.
So we can communicate again.
All right. I was just about to say it was suggested that we send our kids for 10 years to Japan. You send your kids for 10 years to the United States. It was also suggested that our teenagers would probably drive you crazy.
Well, how? How do they cause problems in Japan if they come? Well, they may be American teenagers are so powerful.
The Japanese didn't take that as a joke, Bob.
Oh, boy, am I in trouble now. Okay. Ask him.
I served as a host family for American kids before, but I didn't have any problems.
Good. You come
this
here.
This was a remark from Mr. Bando.
Okay. Is Mr. Bando listening?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Bando, yes. Do you know the name Bob? Hey. Do you know the name Bob Costas? Sportscaster.
Sportscaster.
Ah, so desu ka.
Shitte masu?
Yeah, boku wa ima shiranai.
Well, I don't know him.
No.
I don't know.
Well, no.
All right. The reason I ask is because he just walked into the studio here, and he's one of our premier sports broadcasters, baseball, football, basketball, you name it. And he lives here in St. Louis, and he just wanted to say hello to you, Bando. Bob, do you know Bando? Have you ever looked back over his baseball history?
No, I haven't. So I'm as equally unfamiliar with him as he is with me. So we start out on equal ground, but the common ground would be baseball because it is the national game of Japan as well as of the United States. And many American players, former American players, are performing now in Japan. And maybe he could give us an update as to some familiar names of American players who are playing Japanese baseball now.
All right. Could you help us with that, Bando?
Well, from Hanshin Tigers, we have fielders now playing in the United States. I knew him very well. And also, Johnson of Mets. He was in Japan before.
Howard Johnson. No, Davey Johnson.
And
Davey, yeah, the former manager.
Parrish.
Larry Parrish.
Cromarty.
Bryant. Destrade.
Destrade.
Gossage.
Goose Gossage.
Yes. Vance Law.
Did you pick up that first Cecil Fielder who's now leading the league in Detroit? Yeah. Right. Who played last year, of course, in Japan.
In Detroit, the joke is that Cecil Fielder now has 43 home runs. And as the gentleman said, he played last year in Japan. And the joke in Detroit is that he is the only Japanese import that's popular in the Motor City.
Well, that's very interesting. Fielder was in Japan, and now Fielder is very successful in the United States. And only Fielder is very popular among various import products or imported things from Japan. Now Fielder is back in the United States, and after he left Japan.
So Bob, I think your little slip about sending American teenagers over here just passed everyone by. But they got the joke about Detroit.
And now Japanese Hanshin Tigers, which lost Fielders, is now at the bottom of the ranking.
Much like our own St. Louis Cardinals.
You had to say
I think we're
it,
getting
you?
To the end of the program. We're getting to the end of the program over here, Bob. We're going to be sending a Japanese song.
Da-da-da. That's how, you know, they played the song out and that was it. How cool is that? So that was going back into the KMOX archives from September 4th, 1990, midnight here in St. Louis. It was broadcast to Japan a Tuesday night. Bob Costas just happened to roll in the KMOX studios midnight on a Tuesday. How about that? Isn't that cool? So with the story of Bob Costas that is running on ESPN Outside the Lines, I thought, you know, I've been meaning to play the surprise Costas appearance. You think about him in all of these great capacities. I have some really awesome highlights from the closing moments of a St. Louis Spirits win from 1975. I have that saved. And I thought I could play that, but this is more fascinating to me. He just happened to roll in and do his thing and just ask some questions and the hookup to Japan. Very cool. I hope you enjoyed that. I'm really having fun going back through some of these KMOX archives and sharing some of those moments with you. Coming up next, Larry Jorgensen. I wanted to replay this interview with him. He's the Coca-Cola enthusiast. You may remember him, wrote a book. I want to talk to him about his favorite brand on Overnight America KMOX. Joining us now is someone that has a book out about Coca-Cola, some interesting facts about it, Larry Jorgensen. Thank you so much for joining us here tonight.
Hey, thank you, Ryan. A pleasure to be with you and tell you some stories about Coca-Cola.
I have been to the Atlanta headquarters once. We went through a tour when I was younger, and I remember at the very end, you had free samples of Coca-Cola from different countries. You got to taste what it was from other countries. And I remember how grossed out I was from places like Italy, and I was like, it just tasted different. I thought Coca-Cola was the same everywhere. I guess not. I got a lot to learn about Coca-Cola, and that's what your book's about, isn't it?
That's correct, Ryan. The book, in fact, is not about Atlanta. It's about all the people and places around the country that actually contributed to making Coca-Cola. It's, you know, it's the pioneers, the guys that said, I think I'm going to try to bottle this. I think there has potential here to be a good business.
Yeah.
And it's pretty unique how they got into it.
How far back do you go?
Well, the book goes all the way back to when Coca-Cola was first bottled. And surprise, it was not first bottled in Atlanta. It was first bottled in Vicksburg, Mississippi, just down the river from St. Louis. Joe Biedenharn, who had a candy shop and a soda fountain, decided that he was buying the Coca-Cola syrup and serving it at his fountain. And he thought, you know, if I could get this out to the country, this is so good. And he bought, in fact, he went to St. Louis and bought some secondhand bottling equipment, hand operated, obviously, and started bottling Coca-Cola. And he asked, you know, the people at Coca-Cola at that time that were making the syrup, he said, would this be all right? And, you know, he sent them a couple cases, and they said, yeah, it's okay. But, you know, he got upset they never sent back his bottle. And that was about the last of it. For 5 years, Joe continued to bottle Coca-Cola, and the Coca-Cola Corporation was too busy selling syrup to see any potential in the bottling of Coca-Cola.
So what year would that have been?
That would have been 1894.
Wow.
And it continued to be bottled for 5 years in Vicksburg, Mississippi, by hand, until Coca-Cola finally, you might say, authorized or approved the bottling. And that in itself is a unique story. There were two young attorneys from Chattanooga who thought bottling Coca-Cola might be a good idea. They went to Atlanta. They talked to Asa Candler, who was the owner of Coca-Cola and made the syrup. So they would like to bottle it. And Asa said, that's a dumb idea. And he didn't want to allow that. Finally, after much persuasion on the part of these two gentlemen from Chattanooga, for a dollar, he signed away the rights to bottle Coca-Cola throughout the United States, except Mississippi, because that's where Joe was doing it. And he never bothered to collect the dollar, and he told these two young men from Chattanooga, this is a dumb idea, and if it doesn't work, don't come crying back to me about it.
You know, you hear those stories about people that sold their Apple stock at, like, you know, pennies on the dollar compared to where it would have been now. They would have been billionaires. Could you imagine giving up a deal like that?
Well, and then what evolved from there, these two guys go back to Chattanooga, and it's like, how are we going to bottle Coca-Cola throughout the United States? They didn't have the wherewithal.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? Franchising. They said, we have the rights. And they started selling the territories. 50 miles radius of your town, you could buy the rights to bottle Coca-Cola.
Oh, wow.
And that, Ryan, is what really created the Coca-Cola empire. It was all these independent businessmen who sunk their last dying dollar, blood, sweat, and tears into making that product. And all of a sudden, you had an independent sales force bottling, making, and marketing your product.
Wow.
That's how it all got started.
So your website's the CocaColaTrail.com, the book, The Coca-Cola Trail. Larry Jorgensen joining us here on KMOX. It's a fascinating, so many different people collect Coca-Cola memorabilia. It is highly collectible. They love it. It's just ingrained as part of Americana. I don't know of a company in America that's, I think, more loved than like a Coca-Cola. And I mean, every Christmas you have the commercials that come out with the polar bears and things, and they're just so built into just American culture. It's kind of hard to make an argument of any other company that would be more known for America.
Well, you know, the Santa Claus that we recognize, in fact, you may recall on your postage stamps this year, there were four different versions of Santa Claus. Those Santa Clauses were originally created by the Coca-Cola artists. And amazing. The Santa Claus that we recognize as Santa Claus is, in fact, the Santa Claus that was created by the Coca-Cola artists.
That's amazing. You know, people like to spread these little things online. It's really easy. But the original recipe for Coca-Cola, was there ever cocaine in it?
No. There was the coca leaf, which obviously, if you took it through all the processing that they do in Colombia, you would get cocaine. Yeah. But it was the coca leaf and cola, mm-hmm. the cola nut, that were the nucleus of the recipe for the Coca-Cola syrup. It was not cocaine.
Yeah, that has to drive you crazy when you see those things and people sharing that online, because the wrong impressions get spread really quickly.
And it's such a great product, and to have the longevity and the worldwide appeal that Coca-Cola has, it just speaks to the spirit of the independent bottlers who started it. And there are a lot of them still existing today, although they've become huge multi operations. You know, Coca-Cola itself has so many products that it's not even anywhere close to how it started out.
Yeah, how did you start your fascination and love with the product itself?
Well, I became fascinated with the history of it. Mm-hmm. I'm an old news dog and was doing a freelance, what I thought would be a travel story about Vicksburg, where there is a bottling museum, mm-hmm. and Monroe, Louisiana, which has another Coca-Cola museum. And I thought, these are two interesting nearby places. We'll kind of combine that into a story. Well, the more I researched and the more I studied it, I realized there are places all over the country that have this Coca-Cola fascination. There are old plants that are now museums. There are old plants that are now boutique shopping malls and microbreweries and what have you. And there's a lot of Coca-Cola history in each of these locations. Mm-hmm. So what I decided with the book is to tell people where you can go to see, touch, feel this Coca-Cola history, and then explain what it is that they're looking at and how it all got started.
You know, I grew up in Michigan, and a lot of people would use Furner's when your stomach got upset. You know, that was pretty popular. But my parents also kept Coke syrup in the house, and we always take a little tablespoon of that. It seemed to help our upset stomachs. Do you keep Coke syrup on hand, or have you ever heard of other people using it for that?
I have, and the problem is, the actual Coca-Cola syrup is not the easiest thing to buy.
Hmm.
If you go online, you can track it down. There are a lot of, I guess you could call them make-believe, because the cola flavor as such is a generic flavor available. Hmm. But the Coca-Cola formula, the actual Coca-Cola syrup, is only available through Coca-Cola, and you really have to search to get it. You can get cola syrups.
Yeah, it was just generic brand stuff, basically, that you'd pick up at the corner store or whatever it was.
Right, and it has a cola flavor. I mean, there are candies out that call themselves cola candies, but they're not Coca-Cola candies.
Yeah, in the headquarters over in Atlanta, have you ever gone through the tour and seen the vault at the end?
Well, we've seen it, but we obviously don't get access to it.
Ah, is that your holy grail? If you could have one wish in the world to get into there to see what it's like?
You know, I've often wondered how much of that is true and how much of it is a good story. But it would be fun to go in and see what's in there. And I know that the people at Coca-Cola have a tremendous archives mm-hmm. of Coca-Cola history. They have been a great help in my research, and it's almost anything you could even think about ever happening in Coca-Cola history is somewhere in those files in Atlanta.
Yeah. Do you have a bunch of signs hanging up on your wall, Coca-Cola signs?
I am not a great memorabilia collector. I've met some that are absolutely fantastic about it, and a lot of them are bottle collectors. Of course, the Coca-Cola bottles, you know, the original bottles, the towns where they were bottled are on the bottoms, and some of them are rare because maybe that little bottling plant was only in operation for a year or two. There is a holy grail of Coca-Cola bottles, and, you know, when the bottle was first created, the bottle we're familiar with now, which was created in Terre Haute, Indiana, mm-hmm. by the Root Glass Company. And they went through a few different trials to get the right bottle that Coca-Cola would approve. One of them was actually a three-sided bottle, triangular shape.
Interesting.
There were seven of them produced, and the Root Company said, no, this isn't going to work, and ordered them destroyed. One bottle escaped. And that bottle is held by an individual in Indiana. And it's said that he's been offered over $400,000 for it.
Wow, for a bottle.
For a bottle.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And there are collectors. I talked to one in Indiana. He's got 10,000 bottles in his basement in his home, and they're all different, and he's looking for more. It's, you know, it's a fascinating. The stories, the bottles tell.
Yeah, there's so many great stories. If people want to check out the book, is it easiest just to go to the website, thecocacolatrail.com?
Right, that's an easy way, or it's available through Amazon as well.
Check it out on Amazon, The Coca-Cola Trail. So many people love the history of that company. You did a great job. 200 pages of enjoyment, The Coca-Cola Trail. Larry Jorgensen, thank you so much for coming on to KMOX.
Thank you, Ryan. I appreciate the opportunity.
Mm. And he joins us on the Quiver River Electric Guest Line on KMOX. Welcome back to Overnight America. You know, in the next hour, we're going to do a replay of our interview with August Turek in his book called Brother John, The Purpose of Life. He spent time with some Trappist monks and really unbelievable stories with them, which we'll share here in a little bit. You know, I wrote my blog this week, and it's not really much of writing. More or less, it is talking, as I mostly do them in podcast form anymore. So here's a story from the BBC, and this is what I based it off of. How school yearbooks have the power to destroy lives. No, the yearbook doesn't do it. Well, it preserves it. Basically, we are allowing ourselves to have a track record of something that'll come back to haunt us. That is social media for the most part. Anything you post online, if you posted it in fun and, oh, just you and your buddies, you and your friends, you and your whatever, odds are if it's controversial or maybe looked at as controversial in 20 years or 30 years or 40 years, it'll come back. They'll find its way, which is a little bit scary. But then again, mid-80s, I think we were pretty well known that blackface was a bad thing. So this is basically written around Governor Northam. And at this time, I don't know if he's not really owning up to either being the one in blackface in the picture or the one as the KKK Klansman member, but it was on his yearbook page, and I have no doubt he was one of the two. If he wants to deny it, he can, but I have no doubt he was one of the two. But he did admit to dressing up in blackface as a dance competition, which still, again, mid-80s, you're in your mid-20s, you knew better. But he's going to ride this thing out as he's getting a lot of support from the Democrats to stay in office. Very partisan thing. What does it take? I mean, what would have to come out for you to have to step down? You have the lieutenant governor who had a second person come forward in a sexual assault allegation. Yeah, Fairfax may be in trouble or may not. It all depends. He may look at this as an opportunity to defend himself in court because obviously, why wouldn't you if you're falsely accused? And he may stay the course too. You have two disgraced politicians at this point. One, you have actual evidence. You have a picture, a photograph, evidence. And the other one, you just have some strong allegations. So how school yearbooks have the power to destroy lives is the story from the BBC, which I'm going to do my blog on. Look for it posted up in the column section later today on KMOX.com. If you don't check that out, you should. There's some really good written pieces of opinion on there that I think you'll enjoy. All right, so coming up for the next hour, like I mentioned, August Turek got a book called Brother John and The Purpose of Life. We'll talk to AccuWeather because we wanted to get an update. Are we going to see just a replay of what we did on Sunday morning, or is everything going to be closed down? Is everything going to be just pretty much gone? The lights off. Don't come into work. It's dangerous to drive. Well, spoiler alert, no, it's not going to be like that on your commute Monday morning. But what are we going to expect? So we're going to talk to Matt Rindy, AccuWeather meteorologist, to get an idea of what it's going to be like in the morning and really the rest of the week, too. And who knows? Anything could happen in the next hour. That's what we do here in Overnight America. Anything could happen. You can always text the show at 314-436-7900 or 800-925-1120. This is Overnight America, KMOX.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.